the first question is, what is climate? And for that, we turn to Mark Twain. He said, climate is what we expect. Weather is what we get. Okay, so climate is the long-term average. And, okay, and let's see. Now, there are lots of, in the past 10 years, 15, 20 years, we've got an enormous amount of information on what the climate in the past was. But, of course, it's all by proxies. And there are a large number of proxies. For example, these are the bibliotherms in a cave in Israel. The water drips through if it's raining outside. And if it doesn't rain outside, it doesn't drip through. So the amount of growth in here and the amount of carbon in it tells you something about the precipitation. This, on the other hand, is down at the South Pole. This is the Vostok Station. And you see the three flags. And they are digging ice cores, which contain most everything. They you can tell what the temperature was at which the ice fell, what winds were blowing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, from all of the ions in that. Those are two of the many proxy data. Come on. Now, let's see. It's stuck. What's it doing? It's a short talk. Okay. Okay, now there are several types of climate change. One of them is global climate change that Paul talked about on Monday. You take some input to the climate and you model it. And in one case, for example, you might increase, what Paul was talking about was changing the atmosphere so that the the emitted heat waves didn't get out. And you get a change in climate, which is what we think is happening these days. Now, this is global climate change. These are annual averages from all over the globe of what the temperature is. And you see that from 1900 it rose and continues to rise. Or if you prefer, from 1980 it continued to rise. And that's not what we're going to be talking about. Okay, now there's another thing that can happen. There's another way of, another question you can ask. Okay, the average temperature changed by 0.2 degrees. Now, what does that mean? What happens if you look at, instead of the average temperature, the actual temperature as it's distributed, in this case, over the northern hemisphere? We're going to come back to this pattern later, and I'll tell you about it. But you see, here it's cold up here, it's cold over here, it's warm here, it's warm up there. And when you average it, for the global average, there's almost nothing. But these are anomalies from the climate. So there was a period, which we'll talk about, where it was very cold here, warm there, and so on. Now, these patterned climate changes are ones which are particularly influential, as we'll see, to the history of human beings. Now, I'm going to talk about three historical events. We're going to talk about cold northern Europe, called the Little Ice Age. That was from the 14th to the 18th century. It was very cold in northern Europe. And then we're going to talk about the Mayan civilization's collapse, which was in the 9th century. And then to go back a little further, we're going to talk about the invention of agriculture, which occurred about 10,000 years ago. more or less. Okay, so we start with the Little Ice Age. In the 1200 AD, wine was grown in Great Britain. They had a good... But beginning in the 14th century, the canals in Holland began to freeze over. Here are some people playing in the 17th century, sports on a frozen river in Holland. And starting in the 14th century, it got cold. It lasted 4 or 5 centuries. And the estimates of the mean climate change vary from 0.1 to 1 degree for the mean climate change. And we're going to look at the pattern of that climate change. Now, the first thing we look at is the levels of solar activity. That we get from measuring carbon-14 in plants that was produced by cosmic rays. The cosmic rays come into the heliosphere from outside, and if the solar wind is blowing hard, then we don't get much cosmic rays. And if the solar wind is not blowing so hard, we get an increase in the cosmic rays, therefore an increase in carbon-14. These are carbon-14 values and anomalies. And here's the date. And you see that during this period here, the cosmic rays, there were a lot of them. That means the solar wind was weak, which means the solar output was weak, which means less UV and light were coming to the sun, to the earth. Okay. So this, so a decrease in solar activity or solar output gives you an increase in the carbon-14. Now, these increases have been studied for many years, and they were discovered by different people. The most famous is the Maunder minimum. Just after Galileo saw sunspots, everybody else went to look, and there weren't any. And that went on for 60 years because this was a very enormous minimum in the sun. And then there's a Spora minimum and the Wolf minimum. And then there's this thing which is often called the medieval maximum, and a little minimum here. But you note, for our purposes, the important thing here is this period of 400 or 500 years where the sun was variable, but in general, the output was lower than it is now. Okay. Now that... It looks pretty what?
Yeah, that looks like one of the largest decreases ever.
Yes, it is. Remember, it's an increase in the activity of the sun. And it is, we are now at a very high level. Thousands of years of data show that. Okay. Might be an interesting question, what happened to the dynamo? Okay. Now, during the Little Ice Age, also called the LIA, a study was done by Wappelman and Bradley in 2002. They had the information on what the temperature was in various places of the world, and they had a reconstruction of the solar output intensity. And they looked for the sensitivity. Remember, the sensitivity that Paul talked about was if you changed something in the earth, what was the global change in the temperature? That was the sensitivity he was talking about. But in this study, they looked at local sensitivities. And they found the following thing, that during the Little Ice Age, it was very cold in Northern Europe and Northern Asia, and also in mid-North America. So that's why it's called the Little Ice Age, because the important people lived there. The unimportant people lived in places where it got warmer, like southwest in the ocean off Greenland, in the Middle East, just a small region, and in Southern Europe. But so it's called the Little Ice Age, but it wasn't an ice age everywhere, only in Northern Europe and Asia, and these other few places. Now, we went to see what was going on. What was the response of the atmosphere to having less light coming in from the sun? Okay, and we...
So the carbon, the carbon 14 is an indication of total solar output.
Well, it's a vague thing because the carbon 14 tells you how many cosmic rays, what the cosmic ray flux to the top of the atmosphere was, and then you have to and they swept the cosmic rays, the solar wind sweeps the cosmic rays out, and it's a big problem which has been well studied, and
right.
So you can make all the. Well, since we've only measured the total luminosity of the sun for a few years, it's not quite.
But don't we have a 11-year cycle?
We have but we don't know what the total luminosity of the sun does in 11 years even now. No, because there are arguments about the various instruments that are measuring it. They didn't measure it at the same time, and so there are still arguments about what it does.
What comes to Earth? That's what carbon 14 shows.
It shows what cosmic rays come through. But it's a good correlation, but it isn't exact. It's a proxy. Okay. So there are two. There are a climate anomaly pattern. Remember, we got the mean climate and defined it as the climate. Well, if you look at any year. That's not what you see that year, as Mark Twain pointed out. What you see is something else. Now, when you study what you see, you can divide it into patterns. That is, patterns of correlations have been discovered. And most of the 20% of the 22% of the variability at sea level is in a pattern called the NOM. If it's in the north that you're looking in, the SOM, if it's in the south, we're only going to be interested in the NOM. The NOM is these ring-like patterns if the NOM is positive, at high latitude it's low pressure and the wind is strong. And if the NOM is negative, it's the other way around. And we do have the NOM measured and calculated for 30, 40 years. Okay, so what's the influence of the NOM on, what's the influence of the sun and whether the NOM is positive or negative more of the time? Well, we do know about the solar cycle, so we have the 10.7 flux, X-ray flux from the sun, and we use that as a proxy for the total luminosity. It's not exact. Magnesium would be better, but we don't have the magnesium for that period. So for three solar cycles, we divided the flux into high flux and low flux, and we calculated the average value of the NOM. And you see, the red is high solar UV, and the blue is low solar UV. Well, in here and here, which I don't want to get into what these are, but here that makes no difference. The only places that make difference are here and here. But you notice that the red, the high UV, always has a high NOM, or equal. Except for this little piece in here. So if you have a high solar UV, you'll tend to get this stage of the NOM. If you have a low solar UV, you'll tend to get that stage of kind of a NOM. So you can. Okay. Now what happens that you've seen this before. This is the difference between having a high NOM, like we would today, and a low NOM, like we would have had during the Ice Age. This is the pattern of the difference of temperatures. These numbers are not what really happened. But you see, you get that cold Europe, cold America. Nothing happens in the American West. Nothing much happens in India. This agrees with it's in remarkably good agreement with what Wapol, Mann, and Bradley saw. So,
what does NOM stand for?
North Annular Mode. Oh. It's sometimes also called the
Arctic Oscillation.
Arctic Oscillation, or the North Arctic Oscillation. Okay, so what happened to Europe? What happened to the world when this was going, when we had this situation? The answer is there was the crops were lousy in Northern Europe. And there was starvation, and there was a lot of trouble. People were pretty miserable. They moved around, and it was a mess. And this pattern was due to a lowered solar output. So that the Little Ice Age was a time of trouble in Europe, Northern Europe particularly. And that's one of the periods, very famous period, where external forcing apparently caused a problem. Now, if you average this, you get practically no change in the global mean temperature. This has also been has been modeled by Schindel, and he finds that changing the radiation to the sun will produce this kind of a thing. So that's pretty well, in my opinion, pretty well established. Okay, the next the next thing I'm looking at is the Mayans. Now, I don't know how much Europeans like the Mayans and are interested in them, but this area here, which is a pre-classic, 1000 BC, 3000 years ago, the Mayans were living in this area. More recently, I lived there for a year and was doing an ethnography. I was a graduate student in physics. I took a year off and became an anthropologist for a year and studied the Mayan who lived there now. Around 250 AD, weather got bad in here, but it got really good in here. And the great cities moved down in here, which is jungle now. It's flat land. This is mountains. This is flat land. And the population during the classic time was about 3 million people, as far as they can tell. And the rather suddenly, the cities collapsed. And they used to wonder where the Mayan went, what happened. I mean, why the Mayan were destroyed. Well, they weren't destroyed, they moved. But they moved down to this area here, where Chichen Itza and Tulum are, and there are nice ruins there that are very easy to get to. And you can,
Cancun.
Yeah, you can stay at Cancun and go swimming at Club Med. And it's really lovely, and then you take a day trip over to this, which was the city which was populated by the wealthy Mayans during the post-classical period. Now, the population of Mayans now is down to 1 million, and the most famous one person that you might know about is a Nobel laureate, Rigoberta Menchú Tum, who wrote about what might be called the Holocaust that took place in Guatemala recently, in the past few years. I can't go back.
What's the distance that they moved? What's the distance that they moved?
Well, let's see. This is the Valley of Mexico. This is the isthmus. Well, I don't know.
So this is
500 kilometers? Yeah. It's 100 miles across these.
Yeah.
Oh, that's more than 100 miles. Yeah. This is a very big distance. I drove from here over to here. It took quite a long time, like a day. Well, the roads are bad. My driving wasn't too good either, and the car was terrible. It was a little... okay. All right, now what did the classical Mayan cities look like? These are the ruins of Tikal and Palenque, two of their cities. As you can see, they were enormous. These are the ceremonial centers. Each city was individual, as in Greece. They all had their own governments and their own land. The people lived out around them, and they cultivated corn and various other things. The Tikal, which is this one, was in existence for 650 years, while the Palenque was in existence for 450 years, and they both collapsed in the same decade. Okay, so these are now the ruins that you can go see. They had a very excellent astronomy. They had built observatories. They had accurate calendars and Venus tables, that is, when Venus would rise and fall. They had irrigated agriculture. They wrote on these stelae here and on paper made from fig trees, I believe it was. And they had a great number of codices, that is, scrolls. Now, Bishop Landa decided, got to get rid of these gods and things that they talk about in the scrolls. So he decided to burn them all. Now, he was almost completely successful, a rare success. There are four codices left in the world. Now, until 20 years ago, we couldn't read them. Lots of people tried. My brother used to give lectures on them, you know, because he tried to read. He got the Venus tables, but that's all he could read. But recently, if the code has been broken, they can be read. We now know a lot more about the history. Then we come to the most important invention of the Mayan. They domesticated chocolate. Okay. Now, there were five great cities that were abandoned in a time of 50 years. So, let's slow down. Now, what happened? Now, we're very fortunate in that we have the record of the rainfall in the peninsula where they lived. And that record... See, this is the peninsula where they lived. And this is called the Cariaco Basin. There are sediments in the Cariaco Basin. Now, when it rains over the Mayan area, the water runs down, is connected to there, so it gets deposited. Now, this ITCZ, which is the Intertropical Convergence Zone, is the place where the northeast trade winds meet the southeast trade winds. They go up, rise, the air cools, and it's a band of heavy precipitation. Now the ITCZ, during the fall rainy season, the Mayan area and the Carioca Basin are connected by this ITCZ. So we have excellent records. And Hogg has studied these records very carefully, and he shows us what the rainfall was in the Mayan region for 2,000 years, which is amazing. Now, remember I said the pre-classic people who lived in the highlands abandoned that around 200 AD. Now, this is low rainfall. So they were getting a reasonable amount of rain, and then they got miserable rains. And they went down into the plains and started building their cities there. And everything was okay after they got settled there. After that, see, the rain was pretty good. And then we got a miserable period where the rains just went away. And that period there is the period during which they abandoned their cities. In the stelae, they tell of great battles between one city and another because their crops weren't doing very well. And governors of countries do two things when things ain't going right. One of them is to kill the guy next door, and the other is to move away. But anyway, so this was the period when they had a dreadful time. Now, this period during which they collapsed, is this in here, took for all of the place to collapse. It took about 100, 200 years before they were all gone and never came back. Never came back to that area. Nobody lives there, essentially. Okay, well, strangely enough, you see this date? That's the date of the first Viking rampages into England. And this date, when it all stops, those were the last Viking excursions into southern Russia and various and sundry other places. Now, this was a period of high solar activity. Nobody has it's maybe some other things were happening too, but that was a period that was the medieval maximum, period in that time of very high activity. So that may also be caused by the sun. It's not quite clear. But by the way, there were droughts which are dated. Well, everything that the Mayans did, they had this wonderful calendar, and they put the dates of everything down. So we know what year things happened in. It took us a long time to calibrate the two calendars, but that's been done. So we know what year they left, they know, and so on. So that's, again, where a change in the climate locally caused a disaster for a civilization. Okay, so to summarize the Mayan classical collapse, it was a series of droughts, perhaps associated with high solar output. The loss of climate stability led to widespread dislocation, war, famine, and so on. And that led to depopulation and the population migration to the other part of the Yucatan, and it has never recovered. When I was an anthropologist that year, the thing I couldn't understand was why they had this amazing civilization down there, and there was nothing there now. You know, you'd think that if it was once good for agriculture, those were the days people didn't know the climate changed. And so they were making up all sorts of complicated things. But it was a climate change which has maintained itself since then. Okay, now this is my favorite problem that intrigues me. It's about Homo sapiens sapien. Homo sapien was named by us as being the smart guys. But then they realized there were many different kinds of us. And now they figured out which ones were really the ones we're descended from. And they called them sapiens sapiens. So that's easy to remember. The smart, smart guys. The oldest anatomically modern man skull, which is pictured here, was from East Africa in 130,000 years ago. Now, these people eventually spread throughout the world. And this is a skull of a Cro-Magnon person, which was collected about, was about 28,000 years ago in Eastern Europe and France. And these are the same animal. Also, even later than this, in Europe, there was another hominid called Neanderthal, which is which? Neanderthal, I guess. These will have nothing to do with the talk. This is modern, and that's Neanderthal. The Neanderthals died out or were killed off about 13,000 years ago. Okay. So we've had modern man around 130,000 years. Now maybe he wasn't quite as the same as us, but he wasn't too bad. So we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt. After 55,000 years, migrations began from Africa, and man spread first to Australia and then all over the place. Okay. Now this is a picture from a cave wall in France, which is the most modern cave that's been dug up, and the oldest. It's 30,000 years old. They were drawing pictures like this on the walls 30,000 years ago. Well, you can look at that picture and you can feel what they were seeing. You can understand their feelings. They're not scrolls that you can understand. These guys were pretty much the same. They must have been pretty much the same as we are. But there was no agriculture. There was no agriculture in the world until 10,000 years ago. So the question is, why was there no agriculture until 10,000 years ago? And what happened to allow agriculture 10,000 years ago? And that was a question which I found intriguing, as many other people have, of course. Now, one of the things that happened 10,000 years ago was that about 6 to 8 independent agricultures began to develop in different places in the world. Now, 4 of them I've listed here are very well studied, very well dated. And this is Israel. And their agriculture consisted of wheat, legumes, sheep and goats. And it started about 10,500 years ago. The earliest remains that have been found. The Israeli anthropologists, of course, are very good at looking, and so we know a great deal about this, much of it due to a guy, Bar Yosef, who's now teaching at Harvard. Now, in China...
John, there's a question about this.
What about Mesopotamia?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the Levant, but what we see mostly is from Israel, because Bar Yosef and his students spend the summer digging in Israel. And in Babylon, we've got other problems going on. So it's believed that it started there, but it could be off by a few hundred miles. Now, the oldest city is supposed to be Jericho. Okay. So another place where there was agriculture began was in China. In China, oh, by the way, wild wheat was used before wheat was domesticated. And there has to be a way to distinguish between wild wheat and domesticated wheat. And one of the things that's different about them is the wild wheat, the seeds ripen whenever they feel like it, and they fall down and grow up again. But that way the farmer can control them. But in domesticated wheat, the seeds stay on the stem, and they have something called a glue, a little structure that holds them there. And that's how you tell which ones were wild and which ones were domesticated. In the case of rice, which is in China, that became, also they were using it before they domesticated it. And if you use the same sort of thing for the decision whether they were domesticated, then they domesticated rice about 1,000 or 500 years later, which is nothing Mesoamerica, they had corn, beans, squash, turkeys, and they started 9,000 years ago. And in the Andes and Amazonia, there were squash and gourds, which started 10,000 years ago. The dating on the other 2 to 4 independent agricultures is not quite as good. But anyway, that looks like something happened. Okay? So, let's look at the climate history. Remember the climate history you get from all over? This is a particular ice core that was dug out in Greenland. And what we have here is the sodium. And sodium comes into the ice in Greenland by being blown in there, from the water over the seas. And this is 30,000 years of data from the GISP GIPS II ice core. It was analyzed by a large number of people, among them prominently Mayorsky. And you see that here's where the agriculture starts. Now, this region in here, this time in here, was very cold, and cold is often this grass, and windy, and very variable on all time scales. This looks a little different. So that looks very interesting. The climate became stable about 11,600 years ago in Greenland. And we'd like to know what the variations were in that climate. We'd like to analyze it. Now, the trouble is most of our analysis methods, like Fourier transforms and so on, assume that the system is stationary and linear. Unfortunately, the Earth Earth's climate is non-stationary and non-linear. So you have to be a little more sophisticated in finding out what's in there and what use the Wang-Hilbert empirical mode decomposition, which is built for this type of thing. And it's new. It's only about less than 10 years old. Okay, so let me give you a little information on that. Okay. Now, the difference between the Fourier transform and the Wine over the transform is here. In Fourier transform, you take your signal and you decompose it into a sum of periodic variations, and each of them has a an amplitude, and the amplitude is constant throughout the superposition, and the period is constant. That's what makes it linear and stationary. Okay, so the new Wang-Hilbert, the constant is a function of time, and the period is a function of time. So this it's called empirical mode decomposition because the modes that it chooses to display come from the data itself. Instead of saying I want to look at the bandwidth between this and that, you just ask what is the important bandwidth. This thing. Okay. So, we've already looked at the Greenland, but we looked at sodium. Now we're looking at the temperature. It's warm, it's only minus 30 degrees in Greenland now. It used to be colder and more variable. And if I forgot to say, you know, it won't do if you're inventing agriculture to have 10 years where nothing changes much. You got to do a lot of things. You got to domesticate a lot of different things. You've got to learn to build houses. You've got to change your social system because you used to follow the game and now you're sitting in one place, and so on. And so you'd like to know about how long that took. The only place we have a good idea, a solid idea, is in the Levant, and it took 2,000 years, approximately, although it only takes a couple hundred years to domesticate a grain, according to the geneticist. Okay, so what we would like to know is when was the climate reasonably stable for 200 or 300 years? So here is the Greenland temperature, and for 20,000 years, so we can get good information here. And here is the EMD mode with a 260-year average variation. And you see that until about 10,000 years ago, it was highly variable, then it got less variable. And here is, remember Carriaco, where the Mayan water went? Here is the same type of data for the same time from the mud in this case, and with a 200-year mode. And this is also, you see, large variations until about 10,000 years ago, then small variations. And so it looks as if what happened was people didn't get any smarter. The animals didn't decide they loved us. What happened was the weather calmed down, the climate calmed down, so that they could domesticate, say, wheat, and 200 years later, it still could grow in that region. And the goats could still live there. And so that's what was necessary. And so it seems reasonable to me, and I'm sure to others, but it's not the leading hypothesis. The leading hypothesis is one by Bar Yosef again, who says that, see this region in here? And this one. This was a warm region, and then it got terribly cold. And Bar Yosef says that what happened was they made some progress here looking for with agriculture, and then when this came about, they were very much stressed And so they worked very hard and made more progress. The trouble with that, that I don't like, is nobody has ever found any agriculture in these regions. And Barrios agrees with me that nobody has found agriculture. He just thinks that maybe he'll find some before. So he's a friend of mine now. And he's a very nice guy, by the way. Very helpful. And so there's a lot more work to be done on finding out whether or not anything was in this region in the way of agriculture. At the present time, nothing has been found. Okay? So, to summarize the invention of agriculture, we propose that unstable climate prevented agriculture until climate stability onset around 11,600 years ago. Agriculture requires about 2,000 years of climate stability to develop into a sedentary agriculture-based culture. And this stability allowed more than 6 independent agricultures to develop in the next 5,000 years. So, taking all these three things together, it seems to us that that we have to distinguish between global mean changes and regional pattern changes. That the regional pattern changes are very important, maybe more important, in fact, than the global mean changes.
The last one you were talking about with agriculture was a global change, right?
Yes, I believe so. Yes, the Younger Dryas occurred was, let me go back. Whoops, yeah. No, that's not that far back.
Huh?
I want to go all the way back to the next to last slide. The next one. Yeah. This period is called the Younger Dryas. It's a very remarkable period because you can see it all over the world, in the South Pacific, in Asia, in the Americas, and so on. And the thing that's tremendously amazing about it is that, I guess it's the exit, I'm not sure if it's the entrance or the exit, it only took about 30 years, which is incredible. And look at the change in temperature. Surface temperature for years. I didn't hear it. It was a good joke, no doubt.
From a domesticated cow.
Ah. Oh, yes. Perhaps. Okay. Except they weren't domesticated. They were huge herds of wild cattle at that time, no doubt. Okay. Okay, so, as I say, that, I think, a very important thing for people to take away from this is that that you need a stability, that lack of stability causes, on local levels, so that's in conclusion, patterned changes often have larger impact on human history than the global mean. So we need to know more about the patterns and how they come to be and what they're related to. So.
Darfur.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Darfur is a clearly a, I mean, they have a drought. So there are two groups of people who are trying to live in the same place. One of them raises cattle, the other raises wheat or whatever. And so the place gets, where you can do either of those two things, gets smaller and smaller. So one is trying to kill the other off. And that is a repeated Cain and Abel story that we're all quite familiar with, unfortunately. Yeah, okay, we got questions?
Consistent with your argument, it's worth noting that although the Aborigines got to Australia the first colonists, human colonists, they never developed agriculture. And Australian agriculture is currently collapsing because of climate variability. And it seems logical that the reason the Aborigines didn't develop agriculture is because of ENSA, the climate. It's the one continent which is so overwhelmingly climatically variable. Uh-huh. Would you like to comment on that?
I love to see your comment was fine. I think there are so many things happening now in our weather or climate, and we don't know which. And we can see such amazing, frightening, really, things. I mean, the tornadoes and the floods in the that are going on now in Iowa, where the corn is supposed to be growing at this time of year. And the whole world is beginning to starve. And there are food riots all over. And I think ignoring climate change is an enormous error. And the longer that we wait to do things, the worse will be the results, because one of the things that the climate people have been worried about is if you change the system enough, it can get to a tipping point where instead of gradually changing and being reversible, you get to a tip where something basic changes and it isn't reversible. And Jim Hansen started saying about 8 years ago that we have about 8 to 10 years before we're going to get to the tipping point. And I noticed that politicians keep quoting what he said 10 years ago without noticing that we may be at the tipping point. So
my question, what actually happened physically, can it, 10,000 years ago, it is of ice age, global ice age?
Yeah, what happened physically is that the because of the orbit of the Earth, the ice ages are due to the Milankovitch cycles, where the you get less radiation from the Earth and it falls on different places because the orbit of the Earth is changing. And you can calculate back what it was. So when the ice ages were further away. Okay, so we came closer, the ice began to melt. And the ice in the North Pole polar region in Canada was stuck behind the, it's called the Laurentian, it was the Laurentian ice sheet, and the ice got stuck up there. And then it broke through on the St. Lawrence River. And that is presumed to have started the kind of ocean variations and that we have now. The way the ocean circulates. It made Europe, you know, we send all our warmth from the East Coast over to England, I don't know why. So it's cold in Boston and warm in England.
John?
Yeah?
Were there other periods of stability long enough where agriculture might have been started during the last 100,000 years?
I thought you would think of something like that, Bill. There's a fascinating thing that we're working on now. There was a period called the Green Sahara, when the JPL spacecraft flew over the Sahara and saw there were rivers there. And so the Green Sahara, the Sahara was green and there was a wonderful place to grow stuff. And perhaps develop an agriculture. And it was 2,000 years. So it's 2,000 or 3,000 years, yeah. And I noticed a couple of months ago in somebody's paper that the oldest, apparently the oldest examples of cattle that were domesticated were seen there. And I haven't written to them yet to say, I mean, that would be wonderful, because that would really add a lot of strength to this, because cattle had to be domesticated somewhere. They're not sheep and goats.
You would basically predict false starts.
That's what I would think, yeah. And you have pictures of aurochs in the caves 30,000 years ago. Do you know they were there? So I will find out and report.
Joe?
Yeah?
Can you put that Vietnam in sight? Make a comment.
Okay, yes.
Yes.
Come in.
There's two patterns. One is called North Annual Mode, which is warm and cold, and south. Was just symposium in Washington in May, but people discussed why North Pole is melting like crazy since 1980. It was 40% of ice melt. And South Pole is not. And the explanation is currently suggested, which is very reasonable, is because of those two modes. They behave differently. John gave an example of Little Ice Age, in which the sun was down, no activity for 70 years during the cold rain on Louis XIV. And that put this mode in a state in which Greenland was warm and Europe cold. Now, because we used old refrigerators and created ozone hole in the south, this mode, for many, I don't know, 30 years old, stayed in a cold mode. Although, according to Montreal Protocol, we're gone with cold, that kept this ice stable.
That's because the sun can get through.
This answer to the paradox why South Pole and North Pole are different, in fact, it's in these patterns. It just came from, I read.
It's in the latest EOS.
And it's very interesting. In both cases, the sun works. When you have ozone hole, UV was strong flux and put this into this stable mode. When the sun was weak, UV was low in the case she described during Maunder minimum. But it gives very interesting and simple understanding of stability of poles just using these two patterns.
Anyway, it's interesting. Okay. I don't know if it's understanding at this point.
Since you put me as co-author, in most cases, we're human.
Anyone else?
Yeah, oh. You gave 2,000 years climate stability for agriculture development.
Yeah.
How do you...
How did I do that?
Yeah, how do you get...
Okay, the very well... studied case is the Levant, and they have dated the beginning of agriculture with the glooms from the wheat, and also planting fig trees by sticking a post into the ground, and they have a lot of information on when towns became settled towns, and when they began to grow, and when you begin to see some hierarchy among the people. And from the time they started the wheat till the time that was pretty much established was about 2,000 years. So it's the only...
The minimum is 200 years. Huh? It's a range between 200 to 1,000.
No, wait a minute.
Is that...
No, that you need 2,000 years of stability against variations of 200 or 300 years. Yeah.
Well, when I calculate, I use range 200 to 1,000. Without understanding. Okay.
Yeah. So it's just the one case, but it's the only case we know. So it'll have to do for the moment, and to be an approximation as to how long it takes to go from a totally hunter-gatherer society to a settled society.
One more question. You mentioned that the main, factor is influence on all this stuff, the orbit of Earth. What do you think about aerial clouds?
I know very little. I join most people with knowing very little about clouds. Clouds are great in the question of what effects clouds have on anything.
No, that ITCC is clouds.
ITCC is a position of clouds. That's different. But the clouds themselves, but he's asking about aerosol clouds. It's certainly true that you get cold weather when you have volcanoes, which is an aerosol problem. But aerosols clean out in about 4 or 5 years. And unless you are going to have a volcano every 3 or 4 years.
It depends on aerosol.
Okay. Let's thank John again.